Hello, you're listening to The Wire. My name is Stephen Regal, coming to you from 4EB in Brisbane. Today on The Wire, the Centre Alliance senators call for a referendum on press freedom. We look at what's behind the early onset of this year's flu season. And how people with autism are making employment work for them. Across Australia on community and Indigenous radio, you're listening to The Wire. Thanks for tuning in. We'll have all of those stories and more coming up for you over the next half hour. But first, next month, audiences will be able to hear guest speakers and participate in events with a scientific twist. National Science Week will run from the 10th to the 18th of August in sites around the country. Eduardo Jordan found out more.
In August, Australians will be treated to around 2,000 events showing us how science can be entertaining and informative at the same time. Director of Engagement and Science in Public, Tanya Ha, says the event is a great opportunity for everyone to find out what's going on in the world of science.
National Science Week is the annual opportunity for Australians from all walks of life to meet scientists, do science, discuss the hot topics, and to celebrate our discoveries and how they change our lives. So it's a festival that has events happening right around the country, and everyone can get involved.
Ms. Haas says they want to get younger generations interested in science.
We know that the future jobs are going to need some STEM skills. Even in the country, we need agricultural robots. So where people who know how to code robots, that sort of thing is going to be important in the future. We're using satellites to work out what land to farm and how much needs watering and so on. We're also making medical discoveries. So some of these bright young inquiring minds that are going through school, we want them to apply their talents to the globe's problems.
National Science Week won't be restricted to the capital cities. Ms. Haas says there will be events in regional and rural areas as well.
Well, National Science Week events are being held right around the country. Many local governments are having film nights in their libraries or talks from local scientists. And then there's large events as well, from Sydney Science Festival right in the middle of Sydney through to Perth Science Festival at the other side of the country. But it is very easy for people to find local activities in their area. They can just go to the Science Week website at scienceweek.net.au. And you can put in your postcode or suburb name and find what's happening near to you.
One of the projects to be showcased is a citizen science project called the Great Aussie BioQuest. CEO of Quest the Game, Andrew Robinson, says the aim of the project is to know more about biodiversity in Australia.
It basically gets everyone in Australia engaged in taking photographs of life, plants and animals and fungi. And this data then goes into a database that's used for scientific research and conservation of biodiversity. So it's really about engaging people with biodiversity through their mobile phone. And it's a competition. So we have all the states and territories competing against each other. And the winning state gets a $10,000 worth of cash and prizes. And it goes towards their sort of scientific projects or schools.
But it's not just a game to testing people's skills at identifying Australian wildlife. Mr. Robinson says the data collected by the game will be used by researchers as well.
So our data is being used by researchers and policymakers and all kinds of people, educators, people who are just interested in biodiversity and understanding sort of the map of the landscape of what species are where. It's been cited that our particular data, Quest the Game data, has been cited in 47 different publications in the last 6 months, so the scientific publications, the number of sightings that people have submitted, and that's pretty high. I think that's close to 500,000. And then there's the number of identifications. So we really try to get people learning about the world around them, and we reward them for being able to identify things.
The game's developers say it isn't only about searching for wildlife. Mr. Robinson says just being outdoors has its benefits.
I think just getting out into nature has so many benefits, and it's in connecting people to nature or connecting yourself to nature has all kinds of benefits mentally and just in terms of opening your eyes to the world. It really kind of we get a lot of feedback from players that, you know, playing this game just has made them sort of look more closely at nature. A lot of it is just once you start looking, you realize how fantastic and wonderful it all is.
Ms. Ha says Science Week will present the community with a range of interesting topics.
There's going to be IndigiHack, which is a hackathon getting Indigenous young people to document and revive Indigenous languages. There's also going to be the world's first cancer-themed escape room, so you can think your way out of the escape room while learning about cancer science. There's also going to be Dr. Dolphin giving a talk about the bottlenose friends he has in Adelaide's coastline, and also talks in libraries, museums, galleries, photography exhibitions, and a whole heap of stuff happening around the country.
And that story was by Eduardo Jordan. Senators of the Centre Alliance Party want to hold a referendum to include freedom of the press in the Constitution. So what will this mean for freedom of speech in Australia? Jed Boyan reports.
Australia may soon have stronger press protections for journalists if a bill which proposes to enshrine freedom of the press within the Constitution passes through Parliament. This comes after recent raids by the Australian Federal Police on the ABC and News Corp journalist Annika Smethurst over stories involving Australian soldiers' illegal killings in Afghanistan and alleged government plans to allow greater surveillance of Australian citizens. South Australian Senator of the Centre Alliance, Sterling Griff, says in a statement existing press protections are uncertain and easily limited, saying that a constitutional amendment would prevent government efforts to quell freedom of the press and the right of expression of all Australians. President of the New South Wales Council for Civil Liberties, Pauline Wright, told The Wire the federal government's recent activities are something to be concerned about.
What the civil liberties concerns are is that the government can just say that it's for national security concerns, when in fact it's not. It's actually just something that has occurred that is embarrassing to the government.
She says proper protections would not limit the legal definition of freedom of speech over concerns that legalising these rights can make their interpretation too narrow.
If you have the right model, I don't believe that it would. It would in fact enshrine it. We don't want to see further raids like this that do run the risk of stifling press freedom in Australia.
Civil Liberties New South Wales would also like to see a Bill of Rights inserted into the Constitution of Australia to protect a broader array of rights.
What we need to see is at the very least a press freedom piece of legislation, but I would have thought that more importantly we should be having a Bill of Rights that would enshrine the freedom of the press and freedom of whistleblowers to actually shine the light on corrupt or criminal or bad behaviour by our government agencies.
Ms. Wright says it would be unlike Australian democracy to potentially have more raids on journalists, which could stifle press freedom in Australia.
As they say, the best antiseptic is sunlight. We need to see, we need as a community electing our public officials to know what decisions they're making in our name. We must be able to see what's going on in the corridors of power. Otherwise, how can we in a democracy vote people out if we don't know that they're doing the wrong thing?
President of the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, Marcus Strong, says current protections are inadequate as the balance between government secrecy and the public interest is not right.
They are clearly inadequate because we've just seen in the last period the federal police acting on suspicion that crimes have been committed in the reporting of stories that are clearly in the public interest.
The union says it agrees in principle with constitutional protections, but would rather see other developments to decriminalise journalism.
In principle, it is a good idea, but I'm not sure if it's the next chain that we need to get to in terms of dealing with this problem. At the moment, we are calling for amendments to legislation that will enshrine positive defences for whistleblowers in the public service and also for protections for journalists reporting either wrongdoing released to them or stories that are clearly in the public interest.
Mr. Strong says if there is not a strengthening of legal protections, intimidation will continue to occur.
We have a an increasing and encroaching culture of secrecy in government at the moment, which needs to be reversed and undone. I think everyone accepts that there are certain things that can be done confidentially within government, but at the moment this government seems to be stamping almost anything as secret or confidential, and is not allowing itself to be open to scrutiny.
The Freedom of Speech Bill is before the Senate and is a preliminary requirement for a constitutional referendum to occur. Freedom of speech and journalistic rights are currently being discussed in a parliamentary inquiry into law enforcement and intelligence powers' impacts on the freedom of the press.
And that story was by Jed Boyan. This flu season is promising to be quite a strong one, with several cases already on record. In Western Australia, flu notifications this year are nearly 6.5 times higher than at the same time last year. But experts say while the season has had a strong beginning, there's no cause for alarm. Farah Taufik has this story.
The flu season has already begun, 8 weeks ahead of its normal time. So far, the flu has killed more than 220 people this year, with 6.5 times more flu notifications in Western Australia this time compared to last year. So far, the state has faced 27 deaths compared to none in 2018. Ian Mackay, Associate Professor of Immunology at the University of Queensland, says so far this flu season has shown signs of it being possibly the biggest in the recent years.
It's still peaking at the moment. We don't know whether it's still going up or not. So if we have a look through the numbers, June was the biggest month this year so far with 50,000 cases, and that's 4 times higher than any previous June on record that we have. And we're 0.5 times above the highest July on record.
But Professor Mackay says people shouldn't panic at the numbers of the deaths so far, because it is low compared to the number of flu cases so far this year. He says the numbers only appear high because the flu season started earlier this year.
The death numbers are not unusual for a normal flu season. It's just that we've started our flu season, it seems, 8 or more weeks earlier than we normally would.
He says parents of young children should take care, as flu B is affecting children and young adults between the ages of 5 and 19.
In the 5 to 19-year-olds, flu B is affecting them more than the very, very old, which get the age 3 and 2. So the flu B Victoria lineage is affecting those 5 to 19-year-olds. The very young are also getting sick. They always tend to get quite badly hit by flu, and we're seeing hospitalizations due to them. The young being hit.
Scientists are more concerned by the early start of this year's flu season, which has left them searching for answers.
But we don't really know what the cause is. That's the annoying thing. We know that flu cases have started basically rising from about November last year, well before the normal flu season, but we don't know why. We know the viruses that are there. We just don't know whether something might have changed or something to do with weather or what exactly has happened that caused it to happen so early.
For now, they can only guess what the reason is, which might have something to do with the viruses themselves.
So what's likely is that there's been some change in those viruses that allowed them to take off because our immune system didn't see them. We weren't immune to them, so there's something different about them. But we don't exactly know what it is that could have started that earlier, because we get changes in flu viruses every year, year after year, but we don't get them starting so early in the year.
The changing climate may also have something to do with the early onset.
Something changes when we get our peak flu season, and that we think is mostly to do with the change in humidity and the change in temperature, which allows the virus probably to survive a bit longer on surfaces where they can be picked up by other people. So we can touch surfaces that are contaminated with these droplets, and then we rub our own eyes, and that inoculates ourselves.
A third reason is that because of the evolving of the viruses, there is a mismatch between their new versions and the vaccines.
On top of that, in 2019, there are some signs, but we don't know for sure yet, that the vaccine may have a mismatch with one or maybe two of the strains, of the four strains in it. So it may be that it won't be protecting us as well as we'd like it.
There are also a lot of virus strains spreading this year.
All strains are circulating again, but the main flu B is the Victoria lineage at the moment. We also see both types of flu A, the H3N2 subtype and the H1N1 subtype, but H3N2 is the dominant virus overall in Australia this year.
Unfortunately, Professor Mackay says there isn't much you can do to increase your immunity to the flu, but vaccines and a healthy lifestyle can help you fight the viruses.
So the best thing you can do is get your flu vaccine. Make sure you wash your hands if you're out travelling around in public. Try to avoid coughing or sneezing on other people if you're sick. And if anyone else sneezes or coughs by you, try and avoid getting that in your face. And that's really the best you can do. But the vaccine is certainly the most and only effective prevention that we have.
And that story was by Farah Taufik. And you're listening to The Wire, Current Affairs Across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Researchers are hoping to get a step closer to designing a program to help improve the literacy skills of students with autism spectrum disorder. Using a special program called Abracadabra, they hope to improve trials with the addition of a joint parent reading program. Isabel Starr reports.
Researchers at the University of Sydney and the Luke Prittis Foundation are hoping a program used overseas to help children with autism spectrum disorder improve their literacy skills can make its way into Australian classrooms. Abracadabra is a comprehensive web-based program that can be tailored to students' needs. Associate Professor Joanne Acciulli and her team were amongst the first in Australia to trial this program and have now won Australian Research Council funding for the expansion and continuation of trials of Abracadabra. Professor Acciulli says Abracadabra is based off results of a panel that suggests reading comprehension is necessary to support literacy skills. She says the program has been successfully trialled in other countries and has seen potential improvements in reading comprehension.
The Abracadabra program is based on the results of national panels that have determined that a comprehensive approach to literacy instruction for all children should include vocabulary, reading fluency, and reading comprehension. And we think reading comprehension in particular can be an area of weakness for at least some individuals with autism. We're really seeing some promising results with this comprehensive literacy instruction program, especially in that tricky area of reading comprehension. There's been a lot of work over many years that's gone into designing Abracadabra. And there's actually been very large trials, I think 50 schools in the UK, that has found that this program works really well in classroom situations, and these classrooms are inclusive, so some of the children in those classrooms have developmental disabilities. And so they found some really nice results in comparisons with business as usual literacy instruction. And so I guess Abracadabra is trying to provide a standard.
Professor Acciulli says researchers had promising results when they trialled the program in one-on-one sessions and with small groups of children. However, they found improving reading comprehension in the classroom to be a more challenging task.
The other great thing about Abracadabra, when a child is in front of the computer working on Abracadabra, it can be tailored to their level and their progress is tailored in a way that enables them to achieve success. What we've done, my team in Australia have been among the first to trial this program with children who have autism. So a very talented PhD student, Ben Bailey, who used Abracadabra in a trial with children with autism. He actually visited their home and sat with children and did maybe an hour or two of Abracadabra a week in the children's homes. And we saw some really nice gains in literacy. We then were invited into a school to try Abracadabra in the classroom. And this is a school that educates children with autism. And we were working with small groups of children to see if Abracadabra would work in that sort of a context. And again, we saw some promising results. One difference between the two studies was in this area of reading comprehension. So we know that reading comprehension is an area of weakness for some children with autism. And it seems that when you are trying to do comprehensive literacy instruction in a group context in the classroom, it's a bit trickier.
Professor Acciulli says designing a reading program involving parents, children and teachers to supplement Abracadabra can further improve children's literacy skills.
What we want to do with this newly funded project is to design a program that's going to help to train parents to draw children's attention to aspects of comprehension. So encouraging children to read for meaning and to reflect on what they're reading and what that means. So we are hoping that this program will provide some skills for parents to help them to guide reading in this way so that children are thinking about meaning. And we are hoping that might serve to supplement the Abracadabra literacy instruction and that we might see some greater benefit in terms of reading comprehension skills.
That was Associate Professor Joanne Acciulli from the University of Sydney, ending that story by The Wire's Isabel Starr. Well, for many young people across Australia, it can be a struggle finding work, but for those with a disability, it can be even harder getting a job. More and more young people with disabilities are now becoming entrepreneurs and starting their own businesses. Clay is on the autism spectrum disorder, but that hasn't stopped him from starting his own successful business. Demi Lynch spoke to his mother, Laura, about his journey.
Clay Lewis hasn't let his disability stop him from running a successful business. Prior to starting his business, he went looking for work as he wanted to have something on his resume when he left school. He disclosed on his resumes that he had autism, and he struggled finding after-school casual work in hospitality and retail. I spoke to his mum, Laura Lewis, about his struggle in finding work and how his wheelie bin cleaning business, Clay Needs No Moulding, became such a huge success.
When he was about 14, started taking some of the neighbours' bins out for the rubbish collection and then taking them back in afterwards and charging them $1 per week. And it was helpful for him to learn about, you know, which neighbour wanted to have the bins back placed in a certain way, which neighbour wanted him to knock on the door before he took the bins. So it was giving him a little bit of understanding of customer service. And then while he was doing that for a couple of years, he started looking for a job. And that's just the traditional fast food kind of work or large retailers. And he was unable to secure any employment. He didn't even get an interview.
And what was it like seeing him apply for all these jobs and had that drive to apply for these jobs and get rejected? What was that like for you?
It wasn't even that he was rejected, because it was a case of, you know, radio silence. There was no replies, nothing at all other than the automated emails back to say that he's not been successful. Can't say that Clay personally felt any impact, but, you know, he was definitely wanting to get a way of earning money.
So how did the idea come about of doing the bin cleaning? How did that come about to have that as a way of income?
Well, it was just a natural flow on from what he was already doing. And we thought, offer his client a free bin clean as a Christmas gift, because he'd had them for 2 years. And if he was able to tolerate cleaning bins, then maybe we would look at helping him advertise and do some bin cleaning. And we just thought that would look like maybe a couple of those clients would take that up, and maybe a couple of family friends or family members. And, you know, he might just get the odd bin cleaning job now and again. And it's turned out to be way bigger than that.
So what was it like for you seeing his little business just blow up, and not just with the community and with the neighbours, but also media-wise as well? You got a lot of media attention, which is amazing. What was that like?
There's many different ways that I could describe it. So from being Clay's mum, I would say that, you know, it's very satisfying to see my son's self-confidence soar. You know, he is a different kid to who he was 2 years ago. And he's very happy. He's very proud of himself. And his life looks very different. So from an advocacy point of view, it's great to be able to shout out to people in recruitment and say traditional recruitment practices are not that good. And being good at a job interview just proves that you are good at being good at a job interview. It doesn't actually prove that you are a good candidate for a job.
Definitely, yeah. Because the job interview, you're just showing your best self and yeah. It's just like a couple of minutes with you. It's not actually showing how hard you work and your time management and organisation skills.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, the punctuality, you know, like Clay is very punctual. He follows rules. He follows instructions. He presents himself very well. He's well-mannered. He's polite. You know, these are all things that would not present in a job interview because he would not go through a traditional job interview very well.
That's The Wire for today. Great to have you with us wherever you are in Australia. We're a co-production between Radio Adelaide, 2SER in Sydney and 4EB in Brisbane. And we're produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear The Wire weekday same time on your local community radio station and check out thewire.org.au for any further information about our stories and keep up to date with us on Twitter, The Wire Radio, and Facebook, The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio. Today's program came to you from 4EB in Brisbane. My name's Stephen Regal. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time on The Wire.
close, close to my body, 8-0. These days I walk.
Yeah.